The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The Champions League, Chelsea's march continues. 6 wins in a row as they win 1-0 at last season's semi-finalist Ajax. Has anyone mentioned that Frank Lampard is doing all of this with just kids? Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain scores a beauty as Liverpool win in Genk, while Spurs crisis takes a mini-break as both they and Man City score 5. We'll look back at Sheffield United's Monday night win over Arsenal and look ahead to this weekend's games in the Premier League. We'll round up a full programme in the Football League and discuss very early red cards in Turkey. We'll get the experts' take on Serie A and the Bundesliga so far, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, representing Italian experts, Nicky Bandini, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks for asking. A full debut for football writer Musa Okwonga, co-host of the Stadio podcast. How are you, Musa?
Very well indeed, thank you.
A Bundesliga expert as well, amongst many things.
Yeah, I'll try to be. Yeah.
And over there, sitting in the comfy chair, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Been in that chair for a while, haven't you, Barry?
Oh, about 20 years.
Yeah. Ever thought about breaking out?
No, I like the comfy chair.
Oh, good for you, eh? Let's start then with Chelsea's win in Amsterdam, beating the semi-finalists of last year's competition, Ajax 1-0. Chelsea's 6th win in a row. Ajax's first defeat since the 8th of May, which was that defeat at home to Spurs. Michy Batshuayi with the goal in off the bar. Great work from Christian Pulisic. 2 of Lampard's substitutes. We on this pod, Musa, haven't been giving Frank Lampard that much credit yet. Do we have to start doing it?
Yeah, I think so. The main problem that Lampard was having early on was the defence, but he seems to have shored that up. And a win against the Champions League semi-finalists from last year has to be respected, even though they've lost quite a few players in the summer. Yeah, I think Lampard's doing a great job. And the thing he's doing so well is really meshing the attack and finding so much fluidity. And not only that, finding contribution from the bench.
Pulisic looked excellent, didn't he? And he's a lovely player and a kind of example of when we write players off for absolutely no reason before they've even arrived.
Well, it's funny, Pulisic's strength, I think, is, funny enough, gaining the pace of a game, the tempo of a game very early on after the introduction. And he did that, I think, first of all against Real Madrid in a Champions League game for Dortmund, actually. He came into the game and his playmaking made an instant impact. And we saw that again against Ajax. He's very, very good at coming onto the pitch and seeing the game, even though he's been off for a while.
Nicky, I know you love Jorginho. And he has also taken a lot of stick. I thought he played with real discipline there. Like, I saw him doing a lot of defensive work, which I don't sort of necessarily expect him to do.
Yeah, well, it's interesting when you talk about Lampard sort of getting things right defensively first, and you look at the first couple of games in the Champions League, and he went for what I guess is something between a back three and a back five, depending on how you're playing it. It was quite a defensive approach, and I think in this game, they did open it up a bit. They went to the back four, and they trusted Jorginho in particular to hold it in the middle of the park and keep things together. And I think that both him and Kovacic alongside him did that really well. Both of them had pass completion percentages in the sort of mid-90%, so they did an exceptional job of sort of picking through what was quite a high-tempo game. Two teams that really, you know, as you expect of both of them, push it high, press high, won the ball back, both teams very high up in their opponent's half often. I think that sort of composure in the middle of the park was really important, and perhaps even especially in the context of, to yes, raise it, because we're going to keep talking about it forever with Frank Lampard, the fact that there were 5 Academy graduates out there. You had some calmer heads in the middle of it who just kept glued it together, I thought.
Baz, how many straight wins do Chelsea need before you are a Frank Lampard convert?
I don't really have a problem with Frank Lampard. I think it's Wilson who's
the main naysayer.
He's not here, so you're engaging in transference. I was very impressed with them last night. They played very well against a good side. I'm just looking through their lineup. The only player I could possibly pick holes in would be Fikayo Tomori, who made a couple of mistakes early on, but even he settled in well. And on the evidence of that performance, it was hugely impressive. And away from home in quite a hostile atmosphere.
It was sort of a strange game, wasn't it? Because there was, and I will say, I thought that there was some evidence of growth in the English game. Top-notch VAR protesting at all the right moments from Chelsea. I thought after the goal that was disallowed, after there was a handball claim that wasn't given in the box against Ajax, but I just thought they were quick to appeal for it, Chelsea, and I admired that. But it was very much a game that, a testament to both teams. I thought Ajax played some really nice football as well, and I think you maybe see a little bit where they've lost a bit of their cutting edge from players that have left. But it was a game still that did sort of pivot a bit on that Promes goal that gets disallowed.
Yeah, it's disallowed by half a boot, but we're okay. We're okay with that.
We had a goal disallowed actually in the Borussia Dortmund Mönchengladbach game of the weekend and last weekend. Marco Reus's heel was offside very early in the move, and it was wild. And you saw thereafter everyone holding their run by a good 2 feet because they're like, "This is not happening again."
I mean, it's Promes, by the way, is, you know, I thought he was good in this game, and he's been playing brilliant football for Ajax this season. But I do think it's funny, and we don't need to have another huge VAR discussion, but I do think it's funny how I have felt like when there have been Premier League decisions this tight, it has been this sort of massive, massive talking point. And watching back on BT Sport last night, English coverage was like, oh yeah, but offside is offside. It's just done. It's just done. We're not going to have a big conversation about it because this time it's benefited the English club. So yeah, but it was offside. So
You mentioned Tomori Baz making a couple of mistakes early, but it seems to me that he's such a mature player, and I quite like this kind of, you know, you've got him and Zouma, and Zouma's still quite young. So these two very young centre-backs flanked by these two old men in Azpilicueta and Alonso, sort of their chaperones, sort of looking after
them. Who also played very well.
Yeah, really did, didn't they?
Yeah. No, I don't want to pick on Tomori. He did make a couple of noticeable errors early on. And, you know, for a kid, that could ruin your evening and, you know, you could do everything wrong and end up getting hauled off at half time, but he settled and had a good game, and it was just an all-round excellent team performance by Chelsea.
Just to highlight the turnover in talent, Chelsea won away at Atletico just over 2 years ago with another late winner from Batshuayi, and just two players started both games, the two old chaperoning fullbacks of Azpilicueta and Alonso. I mean, that's quite extraordinary. You compare it to other sides who have a real consistency of team.
It's a bit Monaco, this actually, isn't it, Chelsea this year, in terms of the youth players chaperoned by the older ones. I'm most impressed by Mason Mount, actually. He's a funny player because he doesn't actually pass that much in the final third. But I think that's because, weirdly enough, he's almost like, this sounds a bit pretentious, almost like a deep-lying forward whose role is to kind of end up beyond the foremost striker, which, funny enough, is a Lampard role. Lampard was very, very good at getting the ball from deep, charging forward and ending up beyond Drogba in some cases. And I wonder if Mason Mount is kind of the protege in that sense.
It's just, I don't know why I've thought of that because you were bringing Lampard into it. But I guess since last podcast was also the pre-game press conference for this, where a Dutch journalist asked Frank Lampard why he looked scared and said, "You look scared right now." And Lampard gave it a very deadpan, "That's just my face."
Yeah, it was a brilliant answer, wasn't it? Yeah. The first of two excellent Richard Jolly stats for this podcast. Jody Morris made his Champions League debut in 1999, got his first Champions League yellow card in 2019. And it was nice that the referee made him stand up to book him and then he could sit down again. He was really fuming, wasn't he? Also in that group, Lille won, Valencia won. Two teams in pretty terrible form coming into this game. Lille had one win in seven, Valencia 2-6 in all competitions. Very late equaliser from Jonathan Okone. Lovely goal, lovely first touch, and then banged it in. It was checked by VAR for several minutes before being given. Let's move on to Liverpool then. They won 4-1 in Genk. The second goal from Oxlade-Chamberlain, it made me groan, actually. I was sitting there all by myself and I just went, oh, like that.
An absolutely wonderful goal. Just the vision, the execution. And I liked, you know, the little swagger afterwards. He didn't go too crazy over it, but, you know, he was pleased with himself and he had every right to be.
Is there a nicer goal than that?
The only goal I could think of comparing to it was the Nedved one, I think, that came against Ajax for Juventus, which is beautiful. And it's like a two iron. He hits with that kind of power and it enters the net just beneath the bar. But this was, I think, even more spectacular because it's further out. I've never seen someone hit a strike like that from that distance. I think maybe Quaresma, I think that's one, but not as much power as that. So yeah, I think it's probably the nicest of its type that I've seen.
And I suppose the one thing to add is just that I think both Oxlade-Chamberlain and Klopp have said this now, that Klopp has spoken to him about shooting more, has said to him, don't be afraid to take these shots, take your chances. And perhaps there's a little part of me that wonders if Oxlade-Chamberlain's hesitancy in the past to do that has a little bit of being schooled in the Arsene Wenger school of walking the ball into the net, and this is a good thing that the Ox can do now.
It's his first goal for Liverpool since he scored in the 3-0 quarterfinal win over Man City in April 2018. Obviously a lovely story because he's had so many injuries, but he could be key for Liverpool because he offers something different to that sort of midfield three, doesn't he?
He's one of the best eights in Europe. I think that...
Is that good?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. I think that Oxlade-Chamberlain and Keita as the two eights with anybody else are as good as anyone. I really believe that. And he's a huge asset for them this year.
He could also play further forward if required.
Yeah.
In that three?
Yeah.
Would you, because Origi played against Manchester United, would you play Oxlade-Chamberlain in that ahead of Origi?
Not necessarily. I'd possibly have him in instead of Jordan Henderson, but...
So just reaching back a bit, this was a game against Tony Pulis's Crystal Palace when Oxley scores twice, I think, in a 2-0 win. And Cazorla plays him in. And the runs that he makes from deep, to me, I thought, this is a wide forward, actually, in the making. I think even ahead of Shaqiri, to be honest. I think he gives you match control that Shaqiri maybe doesn't give, and he gives you the finishing that Shaqiri gives. Yeah, I think he's a great option as a front three.
I think it's worth giving a mention because it was sort of mentioned as part of that conversation that Keita, I think, and having him there and available, and I think it's only the seventh time he's played 90 minutes for Liverpool since he joined, you know, a year and a bit ago. So I think him having the option of doing that is with both of them is really important. I also think it was quite a bold selection by Klopp. I know it's easy to sort of look at it and go, oh, it's only Genk. It's not one of the teams that we think of as big names in Europe, but they have a very strong record at home. They're on one of those clubs that, because they play in a weaker domestic league, is on a very long run of winning games domestically. And I think it took a bit of courage still to go that attacking. And I think it'll be interesting to see if Klopp, especially given they haven't got a good away record in Europe themselves, Liverpool, is willing to do that a bit more.
Mane scored a lovely third, you know, Firmino to Salah to Mane. Salah spun a couple of men for the fourth before Genk's consolation. But Nicky, Liverpool didn't have it all their own way in the first half. And it seemed to me that Genk sort of found this Achilles heel, which was just kicking it as far as he could and hoping that someone fast was clean through on goal.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because they didn't necessarily go with their fastest option in Paul Onuachi up front. They did have a lot of pace in their attack otherwise. Klopp basically admitted afterwards that he wasn't expecting to see Onuachi. He seems sort of genuinely, I mean, you were talking a second ago about loving a big striker. I mean, he was sort of seemed genuinely a bit in awe of the physical existence of this guy. He's the longest striker that I've seen in, he almost about, like, he felt like he was about to say forever, and then he caught himself. But he is 6'7" or so, I think, Onuachu. So he's a big guy, and they did seem to just be trying to use that physicality to go straight at Liverpool very directly early on. Like Ajax, they had a goal disallowed.
Great header from Samatta, that as
yeah,
well, isn't it?
Fantastic header. I think it was only 1-0 at that time, and you think, of course, if that goes differently, then the game can go differently. But I don't know. I think, even Klopp said, he said it wasn't a game he enjoyed necessarily. And I think Liverpool, despite the scoreline, definitely had phases of the game where they looked quite pressured by Genk, like they were struggling with the, as you say, the pace of them. But, you know, going forwards, they obviously had their way, so...
But it seems interesting that their fullbacks, is it because their fullbacks are so high? It just seemed that Genk didn't have to do anything. They just had to kick it quite a long way to create that space. Or is that, am I oversimplifying?
No, you're not oversimplifying. Liverpool's strength is also the weakness. We've seen Sheffield United exploit that to an extent. They were unlucky to lose against Liverpool late on. We saw United exploit that weakness with the high fullbacks. And, you know, we saw Lovren exposed. Actually, Lovren's really quite a useful player, but he was exposed by the high line for a long time because very few centre-backs can actually cover all that ground. So I think that teams will get joy periodically against Liverpool this season by playing in behind swiftly, but it's such a slight design flaw that it's one that Klopp will find it worth living with.
And just on Onuachu, did anyone, like in old FIFA soccer, you know, you could make your own players and you could get someone to their absolute tallest, yeah, and they just looked so much bigger than everyone else. It's like a Sabutio corner kicker, right? They're like twice the size of all the other footballers. It's just so much pleasure. And he had a good touch for a big man.
Yeah. Well, the problem with like a lone central striker is that you know that everything inevitably goes centrally. And I think that ultimately, despite M being a tall striker, like, it's so good having the fluidity. You see the way they combine for the final goal, Liverpool. Mm-hmm. I think the front three all took touches consecutively in that move for the final goal. And that's the benefit of having that fluidity. You look at Barcelona by contrast, and they're all tripping over each other. And that's why Liverpool are the best team in Europe, because that front three is untraceable and pretty much unmarkable.
Now, before the game, a few Liverpool fans unfurled a banner portraying Divock Origi's head photoshopped onto an offensive image. Liverpool have released a statement saying, "To be clear, the image used perpetuated a racist stereotype. This is completely unacceptable. We acted swiftly to have it removed and are working to identify those responsible." Also in that group, Salzburg 2, Napoli 3. This was a fun game. Dries Mertens and grumpy teenager Erling Haaland getting two goals each. Mertens first goal put him level and his second took him above Maradona's Napoli scoring record of 115, Nicky.
Yeah, he still needs five more to catch Marek Hamšík as the number one, which he will certainly get. Mertens has sort of transcended gradually step by step to full cult hero status in Naples. He's not necessarily, I mean, not necessarily, he's not at all on the same level as Maradona because he hasn't won the league for them and done all that, but he is very much a lesser but still cult hero there. He's unofficially Ciro Mertens instead of Dries Mertens to most people in Naples now. They sort of treat him like he's a local kid, and yeah, he had a magnificent game. I thought this was just a wildly entertaining game in Salzburg. Fun to watch. Haaland is obviously brilliant. He's now, what, six goals in three Champions League appearances. I think he's, I mean, you compare that even to sort of the Messi and Ronaldo numbers, and it's wildly better. There's only one teenager ever who scored in their first three Champions League games, which is Karim Benzema.
Correct.
So he's brilliant, tall, physical.
He looks so much like Alf Inge Haaland.
Yes.
That I look at him thinking he can't be a good centre forward. Yeah.
I was just saying to someone yesterday, his mother must be brilliant.
But I was reading some, he gave an interview, which has sort of now popped up everywhere a couple of years ago to a Norwegian newspaper, where he said, first of all, he said that the dream is to win the Premier League with Leeds, because obviously his dad played there and he was born there and that's where he grew up. So that's quite a dream for everyone to hold on to. But I also liked...
Does he have a realistic dream as well? Or
in addition, the goal is to be a better player than dad was. I like the directness of that. Like, his dad was literally there watching last night. He's like, I want to be better than you. Like,
that's a very realistic dream.
Yeah.
Oh, hang on. Are we being...
That one's already come true.
Are we being unfair on Alf Inge Haaland?
He was a very good player, to be fair. He was a very good player.
Anyway, as... You know, Haaland scored his second goal. I think the replays were definitely still playing of it. And I think the goal music was, still going. Playing.
Yes, when Insigne scored. I know, I thought
it's
exactly
amazing,
that.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if there was ever a reason not to have goal music, you don't have to suddenly fade it out. You just play it again. Moving on. Spurs 5, Red Star 0. Listening to the reaction after this game, I heard a lot of people saying this was a turning point. This was a different Spurs playing with energy and verve and a front 3-4 who played with real understanding. Is that right, Barry? Or did they just play against a really bad football team?
Well, only time will tell if it's a turning point. They played against a very bad team, Red Star. There are two Red Stars. There's a Red Star who played the Maracanã in Belgrade and who beat Liverpool last season and are very good. Red Star on the road have not won in Champions League, I think, in 10 attempts, or in Europe in 10 attempts. And they have obviously got a European Cup to their name, which they won in 91, I think it was, the year before the Champions League started. In the worst final of all time. But the Red Star that played against Tottenham on Tuesday night were diabolically bad. They sat off for the first 20 minutes, kept giving the ball away. But as the hoary old saw goes, you can only beat what's in front of you, and Tottenham beat them with some elan and looked like they were having fun for the first time in a very long time. Lamela was outstanding. Kane was absolutely brilliant. Son was out of this world. And it was a very, very good performance, but it has to come with the asterisk that the opposition was poor.
It was Marin who was just doing lots of twizzles, wasn't it? And then he just lost the ball, and Ndombele ran on and fed Son. Son is such a lovely player, and it was just a really lovely moment when he was subbed off. And, you know, we've all been worried about subs going off, you know, where they leave the pitch, because if it's an away player, they'll get lots of abuse. And this was exactly the opposite. I think he high-fived every Spurs fan.
Yeah.
And this sort of created this sort of joyous moment.
Son is so beloved, and I think it's because his work rate matches his finishing, actually. He's comparable in his numbers, actually, to Raheem Sterling in terms of his, like, you know, goals per minute. Well, at least last season he was anyway. And I think that he's a player, if you added him to any of the front threes in Europe, he'd, apart from maybe Liverpool, he'd improve them, or at least keep them at the same level. Certainly if Barcelona had bought a player like that, as opposed, I mean, they've got to phase out Suarez, I think that actually a front three of Griezmann, Messi and Son would be outstanding for Barca.
What about Dele Alli? He's, by all accounts, lost his way. Has he found his way again? Is he on the way to his way?
I don't know about that. I don't know if I have a strong feeling on whether Ali is on his way or not. I do think there was This is a stolen point, but you were asking about whether this is a new whether this is a new point for Tottenham, where they're starting over, and stealing a thought from Jack Brook, who wrote something for The Athletic this week. He was talking about the fact that Toby Alderweireld, Jan Vertonghen, Christian Eriksen, Danny Rose, you've got four players in the squad who basically want out, and three of whom are in the last year of their contracts. And this is sort of the least we've had of those players in the team at the same time at once. There was only Vertonghen in the starting 11. And were Tottenham fresher for it? Were Tottenham more committed for it? Because Pochettino's teams do demand commitment. I mean, he was just mentioning Musa about Son and how his work rate is such a big part of why he's so beloved. And perhaps to get that work rate from people, you need to have players who really want to be there. And so there may be something in the turnover that matters. I mean, Dele Alli, as far as I know, has no desire to be out of Tottenham. So him, it's something more just about form and being in or out of it. But there is a question there of whether Tottenham are better off putting aside some of these players who have done such a good job for them at this point and starting afresh a little bit, which admittedly for Pochettino would be a pretty bitter pill to swallow a year out from being in the Champions League, having to revolutionise.
So if you were Pochettino, would you not start Alderweireld and Vertonghen away at Anfield?
Well, right, because they're your best two centre-backs. I mean, there's no way you can convince me that Sanchez and Foyth are a better pair of talents at centre-back. But, I'm not sort of strongly making this case because, again, it's not even my point. It's just an interesting point that I read this week and was curious about. But I think it's certainly something that seems relevant when you consider, again, Pochettino's best work, his best teams have always been furiously hardworking. It was the knock on him for a long time was that his teams get tired late in seasons. And I can see the argument.
Also in that group, Olympiacos 2, Bayern Munich 3. Bayern letting in goals at the moment, 1 point out of six before they 1 point out of six since they smashed Spurs. Olympiacos took the lead, 2 from Lewandowski, his 57th and 58th Champions League goals. He's now 5th in the all-time list. Tolisso scored a lovely third before Olympiacos got one back. So 3 wins from 3 for Bayern. Spurs 2nd with 4 points. Next round of fixtures is the return of these ones for everyone in a couple of weeks' time. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with Manchester City's hammering of Atalanta. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Our live show's coming up next Wednesday, the Science Museum, Football Weekly versus Science, a sellout, 27th of November at the Indigo, at the O2 in London. This is our Christmas special, Barry, isn't it?
Yes, even though it's in November.
Yes. Me, you, Jonathan Wilson and Ellis James. Sell it to the people, Barry.
Well, I think the day after this show, I should be leaving the country to go on a big holiday.
Okay.
I'm going to find myself in India, commune, grow my hair, dreadlocks, wear tatty string bracelets, do stuff with beads.
So this will be the last time anyone gets to see you as you?
Yes, because when I come back, I will be a completely different person. I will have communed with the nature, possibly ridden an elephant. Not in that way.
Thank you, Barry.
What are you going to do with beads?
Not what you're...
Nicky Bandini!
On that. Well, you leapt on that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It was left out.
Should I sell it to the people in a different way?
Listen.
No, I'd love everyone to come. They're always a good laugh. Ellis is great. Jonathan Wilson is Jonathan Wilson. It'll be fun.
It will be fun, yeah. 20th of December then, Belgrave Music Hall in Leeds. Me, Lars Wilson, and one more, because Barry is finding himself full of beads and elephants.
I'll need a comfy chair then.
Oh, God.
And then, it's your fault, Nicky.
Sorry.
What have I got into? Oh,
and the 27th and 28th of January, Liberty Hall, Dublin. We've sold out the 27th. So come on the 28th, please. Me, Barry, and two more that we'll pick up along the way. Right, at the Etihad then, Manchester City 5, Atalanta 1. Raheem Sterling with a hat-trick. He's finishing. He's so good now. And positionally, like, he knows where to be. He's sort of half winger, half centre forward. And Nicky, it's a drum that you have banged for a while. Footballers can get better at things.
Yes. And, shock. And he surprisingly, is, unlike all the rest of us who just say static all through our lives and don't change, footballers are capable of evolution.
They really are. 16 in 17 for club and country. I mean, he did miss that one-on-one at 5-1, but his finishing is just a joy now, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And this game was, I think I, if I remember right, in my sort of segment, honestly, on Monday, predicted that Atalanta would come and play good football and get walloped. And that's exactly what happened. I thought for half an hour, Atalanta actually took the game to City a little bit. And the penalty was a bit of a needless one, but nevertheless sort of generated by Atalanta being on the front foot a bit and being getting into City's penalty area. And you sort of had that moment of thinking, well, could this be a game after all? And then, of course, it couldn't, because once City got going forward and once Sterling got going, there was no contest. But, I mean, he's brilliant. I think Atalanta made things pretty easy for him at times. I think some of the defending was bad, as it had been even at the weekend, when Atalanta managed to throw away a 3-goal lead after, it was like 69 minutes when they conceded their first goal against Lazio, and they still managed to draw 3-all. So, yes, this was not necessarily the stiffest test he'll face all season, but he's playing brilliantly at the moment.
The next chapter in the Phil Foden obsession, Moussa, he started, he played very well, he got sent off for two pretty soft yellow cards. Right. Pep said, look, he'll learn. He's such a lovely player, though, isn't he?
He's an excellent player. You know, Guardiola seems to collect types of footballer. He seems to hoard all the number eights. Actually, so does Klopp, to be honest. And Foden's another one of those. You can see him slotting in very naturally alongside Bernardo Silva and De Bruyne for several years to come. And the two yellow cards were laughable, really. You could see they were yellows, but I don't think this is a major speed bump for a player like Foden. I think he is, you know, really one of the futures of City's and England's midfields.
I think a wiser head, maybe, or a more experienced head, would have not committed the foul that earned him the second yellow.
Right.
There was no need for it. They were, you know, winning at a canter. But, yeah.
Good player, yeah. Pep, well, furious with John Stones for not having his shin pads on. I mean, you do wonder how a substitute can not be ready.
That would drive me insane.
There's a finite number of things you need to have.
Also, I think Pep and performative anger. I think he'd sort of, I haven't been angry today, so let me just do that. He has
such
his moments.
A cynic.
I am, of course, I'm a football writer. Like, you know, Pep had to have his moment. And he had to sort of, you know, the grand teacher, he's amazing, Coach Pep, but I think there are also times when he's like, I have to have an instruction per match, and this was his instruction.
I don't disagree with you, but I can still understand why he would be seething, as I would be.
Yeah.
Why aren't you ready? You know, you have one job. Why aren't your shin pads on? Why aren't your socks tied up? Why are you fiddling around with your laces? Why haven't you got your shirt on? Just be ready. It's not hard.
I did think that, had that been me, I'd have definitely taken much longer because I was panicking. You know, like, it sort of turned into a game show where Pep is shouting at people to do things and suddenly you panic going, I can't get my shin pads in. If he just said, go and do it. But yeah, it was a funny moment. Rodri's hamstring went. There are problems at the back for City. You know, they played two centre mids against Palace, so they can clearly cope with it, but eventually it could hit them.
You were looking at me, but I think Moussa said, look, you want to say something?
Well, yeah, just that weakness, that triangle, defence, midfield, and the two centre-backs. If you look at the game City have lost this year, Norwich and Wolves have picked them up in very similar fashion, and these aren't the best teams, obviously, in Europe. And going on late stages of the Champions League, teams will go right down the throat at City, and I think they'll find a lot of joy there.
The lad who brought Sterling down for the penalty, Nicky, Andrea Masiello. He's 33. He looks about 95, doesn't he?
He does.
It's a tough existence he's had. This is great from the Manchester Evening News. Manchester City have been left red-faced after an advertisement appeared for social media influencers to promote Champions League matches at the Etihad. A post on an app called Tribe, a way of connecting brands to people with social media followings, appeared asking for 18 to 55-year-old male Mancunians and or Man City fans to produce content that is, quote, fan-centric, which has an element of FOMO, fear of missing out, at its core, that showcases the electrifying atmosphere that only Champions League live football matches can deliver. The ad explained, the Champions League draw this year has given us three relatively unknown teams, meaning our core fans are less likely to attend. We want to get across the great atmosphere of the Etihad through the use of influencers who can tell an authentic and genuine story of what it's like to be at the game. City sources say the advert was produced without knowledge or permission of anyone at the club. The phrase, the game's gone, yeah. Brian, Jesus Christ. It's amazing, isn't it?
Well, what's funny is just this morning I was reading a piece from an Italian journalist whose work I like, who was basically saying, because Italian fandom, actually, Italian ultra culture particularly, but Italian fandom took a lot from English fan culture. In the sort of 80s, there was almost a bit of an obsession with the English hooligans and the sort of ideas that were stolen. Like, for instance, at Lazio, they don't use any instruments because they saw English fans making this great noise without instruments and were like, right, this is the way to do it. And what this writer was saying is the Atalanta fans went and were doing, providing all the atmosphere at the stadium, but the English club was the one playing the football, and they were sort of presenting it as a role reversal of you know, back in the 90s, perhaps, when it was the English fans that were great and the Italian teams that were great, and now it's an English team that's great and the Italian fans that are great. I mean, of course, it's a bit of a an isolated pocket. There's lots and lots of recent evidence of Italian fans being a very long way from great. Atalanta fans are their own group, and they have not been the ones failing to cover themselves in glory. But
yeah. I mean, probably, you know, worth emphasising, Man City didn't put this out. But even still, I mean, it's...
They have put out fairly ropey hashtag content of a similar nature in the past. So I will take their word for it when they say they didn't put it out.
I think the people who created that content should be found and forced to create additional content as a punishment in public view.
I just like the idea of asking for Mancunians and or Man City fans. You know, just...
Oh, my God.
So it's just a brilliant... Everything about it
As a United fan, I say this. It's too easy to go after City for that. I think there are many other things to criticise them for, but it just feels unfair to drag them for that.
One update from Monday, that City third kit that we were discussing is, quote, a mixture of fizzy yellow and Georgia peach. What it is. Someone in a week say that there was a media agenda against Man City. Are we now part of that for finding all these things?
That's very similar to the Barca kit, isn't it? The City third kit. Do you remember the Barca kit from a few years ago? Like a kind of global hypercolour, like a fruit salad suite. It's okay.
That's the most praise I've heard for it.
It's okay if you're good. You can wear anything if you're good.
Your T-shirt isn't. It's not a dissimilar colour.
It's a joyful tangerine.
Speaking of those kits, Shakhtar 2, Dinamo Zagreb 2, two luminous kits. It was only Shakhtar's black shorts that meant it wasn't two sets of Stabilo highlighters running around a football pitch. Highlight of this game, not sure if you saw it, the Shakhtar keeper, Andre Pirtov, kind of reverse clotheslining Mario Gavranovic as a corner came in. He sort of got him, he got his hand round the guy's neck and then hooked his knee as well and pulled him over. That's a fantastic foul. Zagreb scored the penalty before Shakhtar equalising. My favourite assist and goal scorer, two Brazilians, Alan Patrick, setting up Dudu for their equaliser. Group A, Real Madrid needed a win at Galatasaray and got it. Hazard, Cruz and Carvajal all came in after missing the defeat to Mallorca. Hazard set up Cruz for the only goal with the aid of a big deflection. He also hit the bar, Hazard, after rounding the keeper late on. But Musa, you know, Thibaut Courtois had to make two really good saves early on.
Madrid are a funny side because even when they're in crisis, they're not really in crisis. Like Madrid in crisis, look at the league table. They're kind of like, you know, second or third. Like it's not that deep. Hazard having time to settle is a thing, but Courtois is the bigger problem there. They sold Keylor Navas, who was an excellent goalkeeper. They brought in Courtois, and each time I've watched him play for Madrid, I've seen him a few times this season, looks really unsure of himself. Looks like, you know, 50% the player that he was at his peak. And it's a strange signing, and I'm not sure if club or player are entirely happy with it.
In the transfers you may not have noticed, Ryan Babel went to Galatasaray from that little time at Fulham. In fact, I'd completely forgotten he was at Fulham.
Florian Andone went there as well.
Andone had a cut. He's on loan there from Brighton. Yeah, the last thing he did, I think we mentioned it, at Brighton was get sent off.
And he's playing really well for Galatasaray.
Yeah, he's playing well, yeah. Stephen Nzonzi's there too. Nobel Clásico, remember, for Real Madrid this weekend. The other game in that group saw PSG win 5-0 at Bruges. Mbappe came on in the second half, scored a hat-trick in 22 minutes. The third from, speaking of Oxlade-Chamberlain outside of the foot, the Angel Di Maria outside of the left foot pass is a thing of absolute beauty. Nicky, if you were a defensive coach, how would you defend against Kylian Mbappe?
I'm certain I wouldn't have a solution that would work given how many excellent coaches have failed to come up with something. I mean, I don't know. You can't run a high line against him because he's so fast. But if you sit off him, he's going to kill you in the space he's got to work into.
I think you just stop him at the border, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think you just. I'm sorry, Killian. We found something in your bag. Can you stay here for 24? I think if you allow him in the stadium, then you're in trouble.
On the pitch is the mistake, right? Icardi scored twice. Nicky, do you pay attention to Icardi or once he's left Serie A?
No, of course. But I pay attention to European football, Max. Shockingly, but it's interesting that Inter are also still playing. Attention to Icardi. Of course, he scores goals, and immediately the Italian newspapers, even though Inter won, are all over Inter's executives going, oh, look, you see that player that you let go? He's scoring goals. And Marotta just casually reminding everyone that they do still own him. He's on loan. He's not a permanent deal, although I'd be very, very surprised if he finds his way back to Inter.
Just a shout back for PSG for Di Maria this year, actually, because so much talk of Neymar being crucial in the Champions League campaign, but Di Maria this year has been extraordinary both in La Liga and in the league, and in the Champions League, and I think he's the key playmaker for them.
He scored was it this weekend? He scored an absolutely beautiful, that little dink.
Floated it, yeah.
Which was just beautiful. A real pleasure. Group D, you mentioned Juve, they beat Lokomotiv Moscow 2-1. Too late, Dybala goals got them out of jail, really, Nicky?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those games which you assumed would be a much easier ride for Juventus, although I have to say Lokomotiv have been, I think, pretty obdurate opponents for everyone this season in the Champions League, at least. They obviously got ahead and then dug in. It's definitely interesting that Dybala, being this player who was thought to be on his way out the door in the summer, and I mean, he's not the only one, because there were several players who were supposed to be on the way out, and Juventus essentially just failed to make the sales they needed to, even to balance the books, which is going to be a problem for them.
Is that why they wanted to sell him?
Yes, because they've spent so much money now, and the De Ligt transfer obviously was a huge investment. Your wage investment in Rabiot and Ramsey was enormous. They needed to get rid of something, and they didn't. But Dybala has played some great football this season, and he's... I guess it's interesting, because I think these are the situations. 1-0 down in a game against an opponent who is just, again, digging in and just trying to stop you from scoring. You sort of expect Ronaldo to resolve these situations, and he hasn't been doing a heap of that this season. But Dybala is reminding us that he's very capable of it. I mean,
Brilliant goals,
yeah, great,
right?
Goals. Goals that weren't necessarily inevitable sort of build-up play and play you in, but just, no, I'm going to resolve this right now here on my own. And he can do that.
Can I just say, I'm a big fan of the underrated, like, 15-yard finish. And he's the second one.
Yeah.
He sort of slices at the outside of the left foot and, like, hammers it. And it almost, I was like, did he do that? And you catch it again and you just put a bit of fizz on it. It's worth seeing again, yeah.
I totally agree. Underrated, that, because the first goal is a beautiful goal. He curls it from 25 yards. The second one, it's hard to control that ball. And absolutely, the way he struck it was lovely. Atletico beat Leverkusen 1-0. I watched this one. It was very boring. A late header from Alvaro Morata. Enough for Atletico. His first goal in the Champions League since scoring for Chelsea away to Atletico in that game that we mentioned earlier.
Can I say, I think an AI is producing Atletico's results this season. Because, like, 1-0 set piece or header, late goal. I mean, they're just... They brought in Joao Felix. They tried to get Thomas Lemar as the key playmaker this year. And it's just a goal a game from them and very, very low chance creation. I don't know what's going on there.
Should they just carry on that way? Or is it time for Simeone to just go somewhere else? And
he's trying to go free. The problem is, it's like one of those when you buy a bed sheet which doesn't cover the feet and the head at the same time. And he's trying to, when he tries to be more expensive, they concede. When he tries to shut up shop and go back to his old formula, they can't win 3-4-0 with expressive football. It seems that they're unable to win with big scores.
So he's desperate to get out of the comfy chair, but he just can't quite. The lazy boy legs have gone up and he just can't get out.
Exactly.
Group F, Inter beat Borussia Dortmund 2-0. Lautaro Martinez with the opener in the first half, which looked offside. I was just waiting for it to be ruled out, but it wasn't. Anthony Taylor gave Inter a penalty. Hummels fouling Martinez. Roman Bürki saved it. A nice finish from Antonio Candreva. And that is a very good result in that group, isn't it?
It's a critical result, given that Inter only had 1 point coming in. And so they really needed to win this one, because the next game is obviously away at Dortmund. And now they're in a position where they can afford to. And they definitely still don't really want to lose that game. But if you draw that, you find yourself in a very strong position. I thought it was... I mean, this was not a fun game to watch. It was very short on chances. But I thought it was a classic Conte sucking the life out of an opponent, job well done. And one other sort of note from it was about 20 minutes to go, maybe more than that actually, maybe more like half an hour to go, Conte takes off Lukaku and sends on Esposito, this teenager who, by the way, keen Guardian readers may have noted in the recent Next Gen project. And I
thought you meant he was a keen Guardian reader.
He might be. I don't know.
Loves Polly Toynbee.
Did you think the same thing? Sorry. But yes, not sure on that. But yeah, he's definitely one to watch. His run that won the penalty really sort of, interesting young talent, very sort of powerful, fast, clearly has an eye for goal. One to keep an eye on.
Another record for Lionel Messi. He needed one, didn't he? He's now scored in 15 consecutive Champions League seasons, scored after 2 minutes away at Slavia Prague. But Slavia Prague scared Barcelona, didn't they?
Shout out, actually, for Leo Messi's goal and Arthur, the world's slowest ever 1-2. He gives the ball to Arthur and Arthur holds it for like he's long enough to ball an egg and then plays it back to Messi. And it's funny who Messi trusts at key points. And I think the problem with Barca right now is I don't know how much he trusts certain players because they're depending too much on him this year in Europe. It's a real concern. And you saw late on, Rakitic really struggled because, you know, he's off the pace. Arthur was taken off. And it just seems like Valverde is almost, he's inhibiting Barcelona's best football. Slavia, you know, when the draw was made, they were like, you know, laughing because it was such a comical draw in terms of its difficulty. But Barcelona are really struggling to get the ball through midfield. And they invited pressure from Prague and almost paid for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, Prague, so you mentioned that. There was sort of laughter, wasn't there, in the draw. Their directors were all there basically just sort of laughing with sad faces at what was happening. But they've drawn away to Inter. And when I think anyone who's sort of looking at this result and didn't pay attention and just thought, oh yeah, of course Barcelona went to Prague, is missing something, because Slavia had 24 shots to Barcelona's 13. They had 9 shots on target to Barcelona's 7. They had 50% possession. They absolutely deserved to get something from this game.
And it was such an unlucky own goal as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Barcelona's winner.
I say there's a problem with Luis Suarez, and this will sound strange because people have seen him score big goals in Champions League this season and crucial assist last night. But the problem with Suarez is the lack of mobility it's a real problem for them. And the goals that he scores are actually counterproductive, I think, because they're keeping him in the side. And if they took him out and brought someone else in and played with more fluidity, the team as a whole would be more unpredictable in the attacking sense and more dangerous. And I think that as the season goes on, especially in the Champions League, they're going to come a cropper.
Is the reason you want Heung-min Son to sign for Barcelona because you want Spurs to get embroiled in the relegation crisis that Manchester United are in?
I don't wish ill on Spurs. I think that Suarez is a real tactical problem. I don't say this out of disrespect. He scored so many goals for Barca, but I think that he makes them far more predictable. And it's early in the season. They have to sort that problem out. They have to get a plan B in, because come the end of the season, better teams will take advantage of that.
One more group to go. Group G, RB Leipzig 2, Zenit 1. Zenit took the lead. Adamola Lookman set up Leipzig's equaliser. The winner from Marcel Sabitzer.
Was it better than the Oxes?
Do you know what? It's such a good question. I think no.
I think they're both very good, completely different goals, but by God, that was some strike. Well,
Sabitzer's a bit like Nangalans at the weekend, isn't he?
And Benjamin Pavard at the World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, because you just see it curl. Producer Jonathan makes a good point. It was made by the camera angle on the live shot. A bit like Nangalans, when you see that from behind. But I think you see more of those goals than the Oxlade-Chamberlain one. So that I'm putting Oxlade-Chamberlain's higher. Anybody want to counter my argument?
They're both very good. Yeah.
They're both
goals.
Very. Why do we have to have a best
the
one?
The beauty of this goal by Sabitzer is the keeper has a full view of it and sees it go almost full circle and has. I love the kind of strike where the keeper sees it all the way in and is never any closer than like 2 meters to it. I love that.
Did Messi didn't win the Puskas goal, but in the top three. He had one where he chipped the keeper when the keeper was on his line, but still couldn't do anything about it. It's a bit like that.
That keeper was a goalkeeper for Espanyol as well, and there was a long running feud. So that guy, I think he'd moved to Betis, and he must have thought he was safe from Messi. And Messi talks trash very rarely in football, but he was talking trash in that game against Espanyol. And the fact this guy escapes to Betis and then gets humiliated in his own line was so hilarious to watching Spaniards.
Finally, Benfica 2, Lyon 1. Rafa got the opener for Benfica. Memphis Depay equalised. Benfica's winner is great. The Lyon keeper, Anthony Lopez, has the ball in his hand, tries a quick throw out, lobs it straight to Pizzi, Benfica substitute, who just kicked it in. I mean, it's a very good finish, but avoidable, arguably. James Wilkes writes, was Sheffield United's win the first time in Premier League history that a result has simultaneously been both an upset and a formality? That's a great question.
I think that's an excellent question, and it's probably very fair. I have to confess that I didn't actually see this game. I was unable to watch it live, and you'll be unsurprised I didn't have a huge appetite for going back and watching the full 90 afterwards. So I can't comment particularly on this game.
You can comment on Arsenal as a whole. Where do you see them currently?
A team that is not made any sort of clear... Well, I don't even know if it's about progress. I was going to say a lack of progress under Emery. I think it's more about a year and a bit now into Emery's time as manager. I don't understand the vision. I don't understand what his idea is, like what his, I don't know, his bigger picture of how he wants to play football is almost. And I think that's something that when you look at the best clubs in Europe now and certainly in England as well, you see managers who have... something. They have some sort of concept, some identity that they want to bring to their team. Whether it's something as specific as a formation, that doesn't have to be the case, but at least an identity. And I don't see it with Emery. I don't feel like he's taking the team in any particular direction at the moment.
Barry, you mentioned identity. I mean, Sheffield United are the epitome of that. They play with no fear. They've got these players who I think a lot of us hadn't necessarily followed for that long, who are absolutely brilliant. I thought John Fleck was superb, Ollie Nord as well. They're brilliant.
Yes, there's always a danger that in situations like this that we'll prattle on endlessly about Arsenal's shortcomings and not give credit to Sheffield United, and they deserve a huge amount of credit. I wasn't surprised they won. There's always the danger, you know, Arsenal going to Bramall Lane on a cold, wet Monday. The script writes itself. But they thoroughly deserve this victory. It's like... Wilder, he's working on a shoestring. He has a system. He brings in players who fit the system. I'll be honest, I probably couldn't have named three Sheffield United players at the end of last season. I've been so impressed with what I've seen from them. But again, they're not a team of superstars, but some very good players will be sold on from that team at some point for a lot of money.
It's funny how they've taken the place of Burnley. If you look at Burnley, who gave Liverpool the most problems a couple of years ago and would actually defeat them. And what's a beautiful example now of Sheffield United is really we're seeing teams coming up and with brilliant coaching, reducing the gaps quite sharply between the very best teams in the league. And it's funny because it almost shows up teams with more resources, because Sheffield United, you know, they gave Liverpool a lot of trouble at Anfield. And you almost wonder, well, if Sheffield United can do it with far less resources, then why aren't the bigger ones?
I know a lot of people talk about the overlapping centre-backs. And sometimes, you know, it becomes the only stick that people wave. But it is extraordinary. Whenever I see them there, I'm like, what the hell are you doing? Who's back there? What's going on? And I don't know if it's something that other teams will pick up. And I don't know if it confuses other teams so much that they're just like, he can't be there. That's not how football works.
You see Barcelona do that, actually, weirdly enough. It sounds a strange comparison. But I went to see them play against Valencia, and they had Umtiti... and I think Mascherano, like almost on the touchline. And they had, I think Busquets drops right deep. And then they push the fullback. Well, the fullbacks become wingers almost in the final third. And it gives you all this space to play out with. It's extremely bold and it's brave for a team that doesn't have maybe the most pace in behind to play like that. But when you see Sheffield United doing it, you go, oh my God, that's a sort of Guardiola tactic. You know, it's
well, it was the same when Guardiola moved his fullbacks into centre midfield. Everyone just lost their minds, going, right, "You're a fullback; you have to stay where you are." I mean, I don't know if we're just so I'm still conditioned to 4-4-2,
right?
Know? And anything beyond that, you know, makes me sort of question everything. So to put your centre backs there is,
well, it just means you have to be an unbelievable ball player. That's the thing, and that's why it blows our minds, because frankly, they're completely different skill sets, aren't they? Centre-back and right-back. And the one that does it is really best, I think, at Barca, and, well, in recent seasons, not so much this year, but Sergio Roberto, absolutely amazing at coming from a wide position and playing as they call an interior in Spain. Yeah.
Richard Jolly, his second good stat, very similar to the first. First time Mike Dean has booked Freddie Ljungberg since November 2006. Bolton 3, Arsenal 1. There is some Europa League tonight Arsenal are involved in. They host Vitória Guimarães tonight. Wolves go to Slovan Bratislava. Manchester United away at Partizan Belgrade. It's Porto versus Rangers and Celtic versus Lazio. Two huge tests for those sides. Matthew says, can the pod discuss UEFA's decision to let 19,800 school children and 200 Wolves fans into the Europa League game tonight? Is this the most farcical thing they've done, or another addition to the long list of failure to deal with racism properly? So UEFA hit Bratislava with a two-game stadium closure after racist chants and a banner at a playoff game in August. Article 73 of UEFA regulation states accompanied children aged 14 and under can attend. Bratislava exploited this loophole, gifted the tickets to kids with a certain number of chaperones. It's one adult per 10 children, with Wolves fans just getting 200 tickets. I'm all for children watching football, right? That's important, but this is madness.
Well, at least the children will be sort of less racist than hardened ultras is the only positive I can see from that. But yeah, it's definitely madness. It's pretty grim.
I mean, Red Star were supposed to be banned from having any fans at White Hart Lane on Tuesday, and there's a friend of mine, Murph, has a season ticket there, and a block next to hers, there was at least 200 Red Star fans there, and they also had a travelling corporate party. Apparently bans for racist behaviour don't extend to people in the prawn sandwich brigade. So, you know, I don't know how they're applying these rules. Or
it seems ludicrous. Article 73 does seem ludicrous, I would say. I would suspect 72 articles is enough to have.
Yeah, exactly.
Why not just not put that one in? Right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin rounding up the Football League. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's round up the Football League for you. In the Championship, leaders West Brom came back from 2-0 down at home to bottom side Barnsley to draw 2-2. That was one of four score draws on Tuesday night. Leeds drew 1-1 at Preston, missing an opportunity to go top. Sheffield Wednesday beat Stoke at the end of their little winning run there. Wednesday move into third, Bristol City fourth with a win over Charlton. In League One, Bolton Wanderers have their first win of the season, which is brilliant, isn't it? They won 2-0 at Bristol Rovers, taking them up to 5 goals scored in their 12 games and moving up to minus 5 points. Peterborough disappointingly moved top with a 4-0 win over Accrington Stanley, leapfrogging Ipswich, who lost against Rotherham. Sol Campbell has taken over at struggling Southend. He was in the stands to see them get hammered 7-1 by Doncaster. Can you walk out straight away? I don't fancy this. Southend have won once this season, have conceded 40 goals in 14 games. His coaching staff includes Herman Hrideson and Andy Cole. Sunderland beat struggling Tranmere 5-0. Well done, Barry.
I didn't really have much to do with it, but thank you.
In League Two, leaders Crewe were held to a goalless draw at home to Colchester. Cheltenham and Forest Green both won. Those victories take them into the top three. In the game of the night, Cambridge United hammered Grimsby 0-0. we missed a penalty as well and missed a rebound, which was an open goal. Goal of the night was in Leighton Orient's 4-0 defeat to Plymouth. Plymouth's opening goal scored by Joel Grant after a quite brilliant handball from 19-year-old Zach Rudden. Moussa, you were describing it as a sort of basketball.
Yeah, it was an offensive rebound. Mm. Sort of saw ball come back and sort of grabbed it down off the glass.
Actually, the Leighton Orient players, a couple of them complained. A couple of them were just like, oh, conceded a goal. This is annoying. It's unbelievable. Anyway, Premier League is back this weekend. Big game of the weekend is Super Sunday, Liverpool versus Spurs. Do you give Spurs any hope here, Bazza?
No, I don't. I know they played well against Red Star, but that, in my opinion, isn't enough. You know, they're going to meet considerably better opposition on Sunday. I think Liverpool will win. If Spurs play as well as they did against Red Star, I don't think they'll be let. Then I would give them a chance, but I can't see them.
I actually quite fancy Spurs in that, weirdly enough. I think Lamella's showing he's a really crucial element for them. Very hard-working playmaker. Slightly went sideways after his move from River Plate. I thought he'd be, to be honest, one of the premier playmakers in the world, and he's gone off the radar a bit. But I think he's crucial. And I think as long as they don't have Sissoko leading counter-attacks, they might do some damage.
Spurs haven't won at Anfield since 2011, but there is still hope. 7 of Liverpool's next 9 fixtures in all competitions are going to be played at Anfield. So that is nice for them, isn't it? Leicester can go second on Friday night as they go to St Mary's. Saturday sees City Villa, the early kickoff. Brighton play Everton, Watford, Bournemouth, West Ham, Sheffield United. The late one on Saturday is Burnley, Chelsea. Other games on Sunday, Newcastle, Wolves, Arsenal, Crystal Palace. Palace could go above Arsenal with a win. Do you think it crosses players' minds, you know, the Arsenal players, if we lose this, we might get a better manager or a different manager? I don't think Emery's under pressure yet, is he?
I don't think the players are in that mindset with Emery. No, it might be there might be fans who feel like that, but I don't think the players have. I don't think it's at that point with Emery. I don't think the players have quit on him or anything like that. I just don't know if he has a good enough plan. Having said that, of course, we should always remember that there is at home Arsenal and away from home Arsenal, and at home Arsenal still tend to win games. So
that is true. Also, Manchester United go to Norwich, and we were giving Manchester City some stick for off the pitch things. Thanks to Jim, who sent us this from at Front Office Sports. Manchester United and Marriott have unveiled the Seat of Dreams, a new concept that will be launched at the club's Old Trafford Stadium, just in case you didn't know where Manchester United played. The new addition at the Theatre of Dreams will be awarded to four fans at random through a complimentary upgrade to their existing match ticket. There it is, a little sofa.
The comfy chair of dreams.
At the back.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, that's not a terrible thing, isn't it? You know, you're going to go and sit in a seat and you win a competition, you get to sit on a sofa.
I think that's funny enough. That's a very American idea. I mean, unsurprisingly, because lots of good stadium ideas are being taken from America. You see in Tottenham's new stadium, lots of things that have been sort of borrowed from successful American stadiums. But whether or not this is one of the good things, I don't know. But I've definitely seen that concept of fans can get upgraded to better seats, which are always sort of, you know...
In 2020 cricket, there's always like... David, you know, Bumble's always chatting to people in a hot tub, isn't it? Can bring that in, cold February night.
Well, if we really want to go down the American route, there is Jacksonville Jaguar Stadium, I believe, has multiple swimming pools in it. So that's a way you can.
Are there
go.
People just lane swimming? It's sort of like an old lady in the slow lane doing breaststroke while the Jacksonville Jaguars are playing. Multiple swimming pools.
Yeah.
And you can see the action.
Yeah, you know, they're within, yeah, viewing. They have a viewing angle to the game, yeah.
I mean, you can't have a swimming pool that's at an angle. The water's going to...
That's not what I meant.
Maybe an infinity pool, maybe. So
yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I haven't been, so I'm speaking third hand, but...
I think if I was in an infinity pool, I'd like a sort of vista of a
You sound like you're angling for a ticket to Jacksonville, well, just in case someone should be listening.
Anytime a holiday in Florida presents itself, I'm probably not going to complain, but...
That is tremendous. Story from Mike Keegan in the Daily Mail. The Premier League in prep for the 2022-23 season, which will have a World Cup right in the middle of it, have put together a plan which would see league fixtures played on the weekend of the 12th of November, which is just 9 days before the World Cup. They'd also take a year off with the winter break, which starts this season, and plan to kick off the top two tiers a week earlier than usual and finish a week later.
I can't believe we're doing this. It's absolutely bizarre. The World Cup is happening there at that time. It's just... I'm sorry. I know we've said it 1,000 times, probably on this podcast and elsewhere, but it's an absolute farce. It really is, you know.
For many, many reasons.
Yeah. And even the scheduling of it, a World Cup just before Christmas?
Yeah. Like, just it is not right.
It's not right. Actually, no, down with this. Yeah. Down with this, I think.
We should create banners. Yeah. Thank you to producer Jonathan. He's given us a photo of this. This is the swimming pool at Jacksonville.
There's Nikki in the corner. She's already been there. She's already been there. There she is.
I mean, it does look quite pleasurable, if you ask me. How long's an American football game? It goes on about 4 hours.
Yeah, three.
You'd have pruny
hours.
Little fingers, wouldn't you, by the end of that?
I assume people get out and don't stay in the whole time.
Yeah, and you know, hope appropriate people have Veruca socks on as well. You know, it's important. Also, the South Wales Derby is this weekend, starting around an hour after the end of Wales Rugby Union semi-final against South Africa. There could be some hangovers by dinner time, couldn't there? Musa, you live in Berlin.
I do indeed.
Give us a Bundesliga story so far. I mean, 8 games in, very tight at the top.
Right.
Just 2 points between first and ninth.
Extraordinary. So, mentioned Gladbach are top, but that's a slightly false friend as a league table goes, because they haven't really beaten anyone that good yet. They've lost the big games they've played. I think the real danger there, the danger team there to threaten Bayern this year, is actually Red Bull Leipzig, coached by the brilliant Julian Nagelsmann. Here's the difference. Leipzig had the best defence last season, but scored, I think, 20 goals fewer than Munich. This year, they're scoring well. Their attack is much more balanced, and they're the danger. Bayern had a bad draw to Augsburg, so they're leaking goals. Their best defender, Nicolas Sulla, is out now with an injury. Dortmund are a lot ropier than they were last year. They should have been a bigger threat. They brought in Julian Brandt. They brought in Thorgan Hazard and Mats Hummels to shore up the defence. But actually, they seem to have sacrificed match control at both ends. So again, it's looking like, I would say, a Bayern-Leipzig shootout at the end of the season. But the Bundesliga this year is just generally very entertaining. If you can catch games, than do. And also, finally, shout out to Wolfsburg, who are undefeated. They've got, I think, Olivier Glasner is coaching them. They're playing a 3-4-3 system, and they've got a brilliant young wide forward called Josip Prokalo. He's Croatian. I think he's 21 years old, already played almost 10 games for Croatian national side, and one to watch. So yeah, lots of excitement there.
Our Paderborn one to watch. Played 8-1-0, drawn 1, lost 7.
They're a really sad story because they were top of the championship, the Bern German equivalent championship last year, scored almost 80 goals and sold their two best attackers. And they play beautiful football. They've got a home ground capacity, 15,000. And they play lovely football, but they just can't get the goals in. So yeah, great team to watch.
Freiburg.
Oh, Freiburg, yes.
Freiburg.
Nice town too.
Lovely town.
Yes, but the locals are up in arms. Freiburg are building a new stadium, and where it's being built, the locals weren't happy that it was being built. And now it turns out that when it's finished, Freiburg will only be able to play on Saturday afternoons because of noise restrictions. Oh, they'll not be allowed to play at any of the other times that Bundesliga matches.
Sounds like a posh Berlin district. Prenzlauer Berg, you know, they close down all the bars at like, you know, 10 p.m. so the locals can get their sleep.
So that's got to be a real problem for them.
It is.
Like,
and broadcasting.
So they can't play Friday nights, can't play Mondays, Sunday. Saturday afternoon is the only time they can play.
In many ways, it's, you know, it's purist, isn't it?
Can I say, shout out to German football as well. You go past the German bar and there'll be a massive Champions League game on and they'll be showing like a German third division game, and you can't find like the big game, you can't find the Ajax game, it'll be like German like second, third division.
Top of Serie A, not as tight by any stretch. Atalanta still punching above their weight. Nicky,
I disagree that things aren't tight at the top of Serie A. There's one
they're
point,
not as tight,
1 point between Juventus and Inter. I mean, that's pretty tight.
That is tight.
There's a real title race this season, I think. Obviously, Juventus did beat Inter in the head-to-head, but that is the only points Inter have dropped through 8 games. Antonio Conte is having an effect. I think even last weekend when they beat Sassuolo 4-3 and it was a little bit chaotic, they were 4-1 up and sort of almost blew it, there was this sense that, well, actually, Inter haven't beaten Sassuolo since 2016. It's their bogey team. And doesn't everyone just feel like, especially under Luciano Spalletti, who is a character who... I mean, you go on a ride with Spalletti. He is, he's not a man who knows how to keep his emotions under control. There was a sense that actually this felt like a new leaf for Inter. Okay, we can still have our better and worse moments, but we came through it with 3 points. I think they've got a really exciting young core with Nicola Barella and Stefano Sensi, who's been the revelation of this season, is injured at the moment, missed the Dortmund game. But... they've got a sort of really exciting young Italian core with those two players. Lukaku is scoring some goals, even with some ups and downs. Lautaro Martinez alongside him, I think he's going to be brilliant. I mean, he was, you know, he's been there for a year, but he's really kicked on this season and looks like he's developing into a brilliant striker. So I think we have a real title race. Juventus still have easily the deeper squad, easily the best chance of winning it. But at least this Inter team looks capable of hanging around. Napoli have been a bit of a disappointment. I thought they could challenge this season. I thought they'd strengthen their weakest area by, not even a weak area, but made it into a really great strength at centre-back by adding Manolas to play alongside Koulibaly. But they've just been, I guess, the classic riff on Ancelotti is he's a better cup manager than a league manager because he gets them in the right state for certain games but doesn't always maintain it. And it has felt a bit like that. I think the two of their best performances this season against Liverpool at home and then Salzburg, I thought that was a really impressive win in midweek, but they've dropped some points, and in a season when Juventus through 8 games have dropped 2 points and Inter have dropped 3 points, they might not have the consistency required to keep that pace.
Calgary just about survived last season, find themselves above Roma and Lazio. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story, actually, because last season they were sort of, they were almost the Nicola Barella show, the player I was just referencing at Inter, the sort of young Italian dynamic, hardworking midfielder who could go over and do everything. And they did use him everywhere last season in midfield and sort of supporting the attack. And he's gone. And they've replaced him with Raja Nainggolan, who's, I guess, almost the original role model version of Barella. And he's, you know, he's playing well, scored that great goal. But I don't know, they've just they've continued to produce good performances from different people, different places. Robin Olsen, who is a disaster at almost playing well in goal for them. João Pedro is scoring goals up front there. Yeah, they're playing well.
And just on Lazio, Milinkovic-Savic was linked with sort of every big club across Europe a couple of seasons ago. That chat seems to have disappeared.
He had a I would say, an indifferent season last season. It's one of those things where sometimes I wonder if the hype around him two seasons ago was slightly generated in part by Lazio themselves. But he, you know, he was a very impressive player in that season, and he has been again this season. I think the Lazio are they're almost frustrating, because at times I think they play some really, really nice football, and they have the pieces too. They have this sort of twin pivot of Milinkovic-Savic and Luis Alberto behind the attack. You've got Joaquin Correa scoring goals. You've got Ciro Immobile scoring goals. But again, the consistency not there. And you know, for more than half the game against Atalanta just last weekend, they were absolutely taken to pieces. So not really ready to push on and challenge the top teams in Italy at the moment.
Did everybody see the fastest sending off in Turkish football history? Konyaspor's goalkeeper, Serkan Kirintili, he was dismissed after just 13 seconds in a very strange incident on Monday night, playing against Yeni Malatyaspor. A long hump up the pitch. He's in the D, out of his area, and he just catches it, takes his gloves off, and walks off the pitch.
It's tragic because he has a brain freeze, doesn't he? You know, when you're a keeper, you're concentrating so hard, and then you look down, oh my God.
I mean, he's only had 12 seconds to concentrate. I mean, you're giving him some credit there.
I know, but I'm, you know, goalkeeper's union, right? No.
Brad, are you a goalkeeper?
No, but it's an empathy thing.
Oh, okay.
It's an empathy thing.
Mojo says, with Diego Maradona, the new coach of Gimnasia La Plata, and immediately banning green, including players' boots with any green. I don't know what he's doing about the pitch. Getting a priest in to bless players and trying to get rid of squad numbers 13 and 17. What are the weirdest superstitions the panel know a manager had? Nicky, you had a couple.
Well, the first one that comes to mind, of course, for me, just being Italian, Giovanni Trapattoni and his bottle of holy water, which he actually, I think, got censured by the Vatican over at some point, saying, you know, you're treating this as like it's almost like a pagan thing. It's superstition. Like, that's not how you're supposed to use holy water. The other one which came to mind for me was Niels Lidholm, who went to see it's a sort of really odd story that came up, a mage when he was sort of playing and had a gastric ulcer, and then became sort of incredibly attached to this holy man, I guess, and would go to him to consult and take players to him when he was a manager as well. And the 1984 European Cup final, he dropped for Roma, he was managing at the time, against Liverpool. He dropped Emilio Oddi from the team. Oddi played like a huge role all the way up to the final, and Oddi afterwards gave this interview. It's like, well, apparently I didn't have the right biorhythms. And this, you know, is obviously a game that they didn't win. So, that's the one that came to mind. I mean, there's all sorts that have come up in Italy over times with players. I mean, the one that, again, most memorable is Adrian Mutu, which is one of those stories that I always wonder if it's even true, because I've read about it rather than hearing it from him firsthand. But it's made it everywhere from BBC to the official UEFA website, which is about apparently he had an ex-girlfriend who had got some witches to put a curse on him. To which Mutu's response was that curses can't touch me because I wear my underpants inside out.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
If you see Mutu's career and the decline, how rapid it was, I mean, he needs another set of pants.
Maybe.
Raymond Domenech, French manager, he used to pick players, factor in their star signs before he picked teams and squads. And there's a team called Midlands Portland Cement in the Zimbabwean second division.
Yeah.
About 10 years ago. They're... manager ordered the team to go into the Zambezi for to cleanse themselves of get rid of some bad juju. So 17 of them went in to the crocodile infested river, and only 16 came out.
God. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
This is not as dramatic as the one that Barry mentioned, but there was one other that just came to mind again from Italy, which is for Pisa owner, not manager, but Romeo Aconitani in the 1980s. Because in Italy you have this concept of the malocchio, which is the evil eye, and sometimes it's a superstition to throw some salt over your shoulder to sort of stop the evil eye from looking at you, because salt in the eye hurts. He used to dump, I mean, we're talking literally like 20 or more kilos of salt onto the pitch before the game to try and ward off the evil eye, which of course brings to mind that Libertadores attempt of covering your pitch in confetti and realising afterwards maybe that might affect the playing surface.
On the subject of star signs, I used to I used to host the overnight show on BBC London, Wednesday, 2 till 6 a.m. Good time. And Wednesday was an astrology phone-in. The phone lines go wild. There was an astrologer there talking about, you know, your node is in Neptune. And I was just going along with it, you know, needed the work. And somebody rang. I can't remember. It was Wendy in Plastow rang. And she rang every night. And she listened every minute of the show. She was like, I just want to ask about my career. I don't think it's going that well. You know, what do you work in? I work in finance. And you know, the astrologer was about to sort of look at her charts and everything. And I said, I don't want to lose listeners, Wendy, but part of the reason I think your career may not be going brilliantly is you're awake from 2 till 6 every morning. Have you considered going to bed? I mean, it just might be an idea. Anyway, thank you to Steve for getting in touch, who says, thanks for the shout out to the 41 of us listening in Iraq to the Guardian Football Weekly. You should know that Barry's hair hygiene is becoming quite the hot topic around the tea shops of Kurdistan.
Delighted to hear
it. There we are. Thank you, Steve. And that'll do for today. Baz, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Nikki.
Thank you.
Thank you, Musa.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.